Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 13, More Precious Than Gold. Last episode, we looked at the great heresiarch Marcion, who was denounced by Polycarp of Smyrna as the firstborn of Satan. Today, we will look at the last years of Polycarp's life, his visit to Rome, and his eventual martyrdom in his home city. The day celebrating the resurrection of Christ was, and still is, the most important liturgical feast of the Christian Church. In the time period we are covering, Easter was referred to as Pascha, a word ultimately derived from Passover, the Old Testament feast of God's deliverance of Israel from Egypt. In this podcast, I will refer to the feast as Easter rather than the more accurate Pascha, because the former is the name most listeners will be familiar with. When was Easter supposed to be celebrated? The dating of Easter will become a not too insignificant point of disagreement among the early Orthodox churches. The beginnings of the controversy were already sprouting in the 150s AD. While many Christian churches always celebrated Easter on a Sunday, the churches of Asia Minor kept the quartodeciman practice. That is, they observed Easter on the 14th of the Jewish month of Nisan, the same day as the Jewish Passover, regardless of what day of the week it fell on, even if that day was not a Sunday. In around 154 or 155 AD, Polycarp of Smyrna traveled to Rome and brought many local Christians back from heresy to the Catholic fold. But while there, he ran into disagreement with the Bishop of Rome, Anicetus, over the proper day to celebrate Easter. Anicetus could not persuade Polycarp to abandon the quartodeciman practice he inherited from the Apostle John. Nor could Polycarp convince Anicetus to abandon the practice the Church of Rome had always held to. Despite this disagreement, the two bishops got along well and made peace with one another. In fact, when it came time to celebrate the Eucharist, Anicetus yielded the honor to Polycarp out of deep respect for the Apostolic Father. The problem, though, here would be obvious to later generations of Christians. If both churches, Smyrna and Rome, in this case, could claim ancient apostolic tradition as their authority for their Easter practice, how could they be in disagreement? For now, this was not an issue, but as the second century progresses, we will see the Easter dating controversy pop up again with greater fervor. After staying in Rome, Polycarp returned home to Smyrna, and shortly thereafter would become the victim of a violent persecution. We are now getting into the period of church history where detailed martyrdom accounts survive to inform us of the persecutions of early Christians. The material that follows this, and some future episodes, is graphically violent and not necessarily family-friendly. I have tried to keep this podcast all ages appropriate, but I cannot sugarcoat the violence early Christians underwent. So, that's my little warning. With that said, let's continue. Not long after Polycarp returned home, another wave of anti-Christian fanaticism broke out in Smyrna among the local pagans and Jews. Normally, these two groups held great antipathy towards one another, but their zeal to see Christianity blotted out from the world overcame their mutual hatred and combined into a fury of anti-Christian violence. On either February the 22nd or 23rd, in 155 or 156 AD, the pogrom broke out. A total of 12 Christians died in Smyrna that day. Yet the martyrs held steadfast, even as whips tore their flesh so that their bones and veins and arteries could be seen. The Roman torturers even brought fire to try and make the martyrs renounce their faith in Jesus. But the fires felt cold to them, and they remembered the Master's words about the eternal fire of burning sulfur. Wild animals were also brought forward, and beds of sharp shells, too. From the pagan perspective, this was just punishment, because Christians were atheists. They denied the gods that kept Rome prosperous and safe, and so were seditious, ungrateful rebels. The Jews participating in the persecution were happy to see the cursed Menim get their just reward for believing in the teachings of Yeshu ben Pantera. But to the Christians themselves, the real enemy was the devil. His purpose was to use the pagans and Jews to make the Christians apostatize and lose their salvation. One martyr, named Germanicus, supported his co-religionists, encouraged them, and patiently endured his trial. When his time came, the proconsul of Asia, Lucius Statius Quadratus, asked him to renounce Jesus Christ. But Germanicus held firm and dragged the wild beast to himself, ready to face death to receive eternal life. The document we gather this information from is known as the Martyrdom of Polycarp, an epistle sent from the Church of Smyrna to other brethren so that the memory of the martyrs would be preserved throughout all the Catholic Church. The document also has its own agenda. In the early church, there were two major attitudes to martyrdom. The first one, which the text calls a martyrdom in accord with the gospel, was where martyrdom was unsought and not provoked, but still accepted when the time finally came. The other was the more fanatical, rigorous view of martyrdom, that Christians should provoke pagans by openly insulting the gods or other such actions. This account clearly adheres to the former. As a foil to Germanicus, and, as we shall soon see, Polycarp, the author presents a would-be martyr named Quintus of Phrygia. Quintus had forced others to volunteer themselves along with him for martyrdom. But when he saw the wild beasts, he turned coward, and the proconsul was able to make him sacrifice. Finally, after 11 Christians had been slain, the crowd shouted, "Away with the atheists! Find Polycarp!" Clearly, the Bishop of Smyrna was a prominent man in the community. When he heard this, Polycarp was not bothered. He desired to stay in the city and meet his fate. But his companions convinced him to flee. So they hid in a small house out in the country. There, Polycarp did what he usually did. Pray on behalf of everyone and all the churches throughout the earth. While he prayed, he fell into a trance and had a vision. He saw his pillow burning and knew what had been revealed to him. Polycarp predicted he would be burned alive. The authorities pursued the saintly bishop as if he were some dangerous criminal. His friends moved him from house to house. Finally, the Romans captured one of his household servants and tortured him until he confessed where the apostolic father was hiding. The captain of the authorities, ironically named Herod, then took this Judas-like servant and went after his target. Herod finally reached Polycarp's location. While he had the opportunity to escape again, Polycarp declined. His time had come. He would see the fulfillment of the vision God had given him. So the old bishop came down and talked with his captors. Polycarp asked for food and drink to be laid out for the Romans. The authorities were stunned. Why was there such a desire to kill this harmless and pleasant elderly man? Polycarp asked them if he could pray for an hour or so, and they agreed. The bishop then stood up and prayed for 2 hours, for he was so full of God's grace. Some of the soldiers regretted what they were about to do, in light of his prayer. Polycarp prayed for everyone he had ever met, and the entire church. When he finished, he was at last ready to go. When he came outside, Herod and his father, Nicetes, came and met him, and let the bishop sit in their carriage. As they rode to Smyrna, the two men tried to convince Polycarp to offer incense and declare Caesar Lord, in this case, Antoninus Pius. It was impossible for them to grasp why anyone would see harm in doing what seemed so mundane. But Polycarp remained silent, but the two men persisted, and finally he firmly stated he would never confess Caesar to be Lord or offer sacrifice. Becoming irate, Herod and Nicetes began to threaten him and quickly forced him out of their carriage, so fast that the old man bruised his shin. But Polycarp was not deterred. He gladly approached the stadium of Smyrna. As he entered the unholy place, he heard the Lord say to him to be brave and strong. Only the believers heard the divine voice. When the crowd was made aware Polycarp had been arrested and brought into the stadium, a huge uproar arose. The proconsul, Quadratus, then tried to dissuade Polycarp from his path towards martyrdom. He told the bishop to respect his age, to swear by the divine genius of the emperor, and to renounce his atheism. "Away with the atheists," Quadratus insisted. So Polycarp looked at the wicked crowd of pagans and Jews and pointed at them, saying, "Away with the atheists," and then again when he looked up to heaven. Quadratus was getting impatient. He commanded Polycarp to revile Christ. But the bishop responded that Jesus had been good to him all the 86 years of his life. He was his true king who brought him salvation. Quadratus would not give up, but Polycarp remained steadfast. The bishop stated how he would teach the proconsul the truth of Christianity if he so wished. For while the crowd was wicked and unworthy to hear the truth, Christians were taught to respect civil authorities. The governor was unmoved. He first threatened Polycarp with wild beasts, and then threatened him with a burning at a pyre. Polycarp told Quadratus that while the fire of the pyre burns for a short while, an eternal fire of judgment awaits the unrighteous. Finally, Quadratus gave up and informed the crowd that Polycarp confessed he was a Christian. The crowd became enraged, and the bishop was shortly on his way to be burned, thus fulfilling his vision. The process of preparing the pyre was amazingly quick. The Jews especially were eager to gather the necessary materials for the bishop's death, apparently not uncommon. When his pyre was ready, Polycarp removed his clothing and shoes. He normally did not remove even his shoes, because the faithful were eagerly desiring to touch his holy flesh on a usual basis. He was then tied to the wood and awaited the fire. He let out one last prayer to the God of the universe. After he said Amen, the Romans lit the pyre. But something strange happened. The fire arced itself around his body so that it would not burn him. A sweet aroma arose, and Polycarp seemed like a beautiful burnt offering to the Lord. When the soldiers finally realized what was happening, one of them stabbed him, and out of Polycarp's wound came a dove and a waterfall of blood. So much blood that it extinguished the flames. Thus, on February 22nd, or 23rd, 155 or 156 AD, Polycarp, disciple of John and apostolic father, died a martyr. He was 86 years old and had been bishop of Smyrna for about 50 years. The Jews then incited the authorities to cremate Polycarp's body, saying that the Christians would worship it instead of Christ, their God. This was a slur against the Christian practice of venerating the relics of holy martyrs. The author of The Martyrdom of Polycarp vehemently denies that reverencing the martyrs causes them to abandon Christ, which he says is impossible. Rather, the martyrs are accorded their due honor as disciples of the Lord. The local centurion did cremate the body, but local Christians were able to recover the bones and place them in a special place. The bishop's relics are described as being, quote, more valuable than precious stones and finer than refined gold. The Martyrdom of Polycarp, chapter 18, verse 2, Holmes' translation. From that point forward, Christians in the area would gather at the place that held Polycarp's relics on the anniversary of his martyrdom and celebrate his entry into paradise. The Martyrdom of Polycarp is a turning point in our story. It both closes and begins an era. Polycarp was the last known disciple of the apostles, and with him, the generation that had followed Peter, Paul, John, and James died. There were no more eyewitnesses of Jesus' original followers. In their place would arise their successors, the succeeding bishops, and the apologists. As we progress through the second century, we shall encounter these persons as our main characters. Polycarp's death also begins the era of detailed accounts of the persecutions. Between now and the 3rd century, there are only a handful of authentic accounts of martyrs. In later centuries, many fictitious stories about martyrs would pop up. Though the individual martyrs themselves probably existed, legend has since obscured any real history besides personal names. So, I will only include historical martyrdoms in the podcast, and will note when legendary elements sometimes appear. Luckily for us today, the Martyrdom of Polycarp is an eyewitness account of the events, and though highly colored, provides detailed and reliable information. Next episode, we will focus on perhaps the greatest of the second century apologists, Justin Martyr. Before we go, one housekeeping item is in order. Since none of you sent me comments or emails over what day of the week you preferred for the posting schedule, I took your silence as evidence that you really didn't mind. So until someone says otherwise, between Saturday and Tuesday night will be the days I post new episodes. As always, thank you for listening. Please comment, review, and subscribe. Your input is extremely valued and very encouraging for me. I read every comment. If I don't respond on the blog site, I will certainly respond in the podcast itself. Please keep the feedback coming. Be sure to like the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast, and invite anyone you would think would be interested in the history of the Early Church Podcast. If you have thoughts or questions about the podcast, you can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com, and don't forget to visit the website at historyoftheearlychurch.com.